The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to America's Web Radio. It's time now for the Doctor's Lounge Show with Dr. Scott Barber.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Scott Barber, and you're listening to me on America's Web Radio. And today we're going to talk about healthcare reform. So the topic today was inspired by a podcast I was listening to. I think I was listening to the Charlie Kirk podcast. And somebody mentioned that one of the things Trump needs in this upcoming election is a healthcare plan. And that immediately triggered me because I realized there's not going to be a healthcare plan. And there's not going to be a healthcare plan because there can't be a healthcare plan. So what you're going to get is kind of more of the same, which is a version of government-controlled healthcare. And the reason you're going to get that is because healthcare is extraordinarily complicated. It has so many layers to it, and it's really something that almost none of us has a command of. I've been doing this now for, I've been in medicine for over 30 years. I started medical school in 1992. So I've been in medicine for 32 years now, seeing the inside of all the different characters, the doctors, the training. I've been in hospital systems from coast to coast. I've met people from foreign countries and seen how their healthcare systems work. I've thought about the concept of healthcare forever, you know, even back when people would talk about the Scandinavian countries and how they had this great utopian healthcare. And the fact is they don't. I lived through the nightmare of having to listen to sycophants, who support government controlled healthcare tell me how awesome Canada was, only to see that place collapse. And now I just have enough personal experience that I see the playing field so clearly, and I wish I could just kind of transfer what I'm seeing on the healthcare field to all of you so that you could make an informed decision. But this idea of having a healthcare plan is not possible. Healthcare is just so immensely complex. And if you have read Friedrich Hayek's The Road to Serfdom, he's an economist, and he talks about the wants, needs, and desires of all of the billions of individuals on the human planet are so complex and diverse that no person or group of people could possibly manage them, right? And for that reason, people need to have control of their own destiny. And that's why free markets work so well, because it allows the free interaction of buyers and sellers to agree upon infinite numbers of interactions. And interactions that other people have eventually affect what I do. So there's a competitive marketplace for lead that goes into pencils. I'm thinking back on something I read from Thomas Sowell, where he talks about, or no, this would be Milton Friedman, where he talks about all the people that go into making a pencil that have never met one another, and the lead from Madagascar and the wood from another place and the metal for the tip and the eraser, where it comes from, and how all these things get put together in a simple thing. And then I get this pencil through the interactions of so many different people that I never met that provide me with this very simple utensil at the lowest possible price. And that is the free market. And so the thing that we need to solve healthcare is to do nothing. Right. You heard me correctly. What do you mean do nothing? Just get out of the way and allow the practitioners of healthcare to compete in an open marketplace, and they will provide the highest quality of medicine with the most choices at the lowest price. And why will that be? That's because that's how economics works. And in order for us to understand how to reform healthcare, which again is to basically just get government out of the way, we need to kind of understand some basic economics, because in essence, healthcare is a part of the economy. In fact, it's 20% of our economy, and the production and delivery of healthcare goods and services is an economic endeavor. And in order for an economic endeavor to work, we got to understand basic economics, right? And one of the most important things that we talk about on this show is the four ways to spend money, right? You can have other people spend money on other people, right? That's the worst way to spend money, right? And the best way to spend money is for you to spend your own money on you, right? We talk about the cost and quality. So if you're spending your money and you're spending it on you, cost matters, it's your money, and quality matters, the product is for you. If you spend your money on somebody else, cost matters because it's your money. Quality doesn't matter as much because you're buying it for somebody else. If you use other people's money to buy for yourself, then cost doesn't matter at all. It's not your money, but the quality does because it's for you. And if you're using other people's money on other people, cost doesn't matter and quality doesn't matter. It's not your money and it's not for you. And that's the situation we find ourselves in with healthcare. And listening to the podcast where they said the one thing Trump needs to do in this upcoming campaign is come up with a healthcare plan, it really triggered me because I have been involved in the political aspects of healthcare for a very long time now. And I've been in it long enough to realize that nothing is ever going to change until healthcare providers obtain some level of freedom and the ability to simply work their craft and compete in a marketplace. And you might be asking yourself, why does he keep saying compete in a marketplace? Because at the end of the day, human beings are human beings and we are driven by the same things as human beings. We are driven by incentives and we are driven by consequences. And we, as creatures of the human race, we do things that we are incentivized to do and we don't do things that we are disincentivized to do. The other thing is, I've been listening to a lot of people and reading some books talking about the fundamental character of man. Are we generally good or are we generally bad? And I'm really coming to the understanding through my study of the Bible that we are generally not good and that we have to be trained to be good. And that at the end of the day, we're all sinners and we're all fighting to be better people, or at least most of us are trying to be better people. And it's a daily battle. There was only one perfect person that ever walked this earth, Jesus Christ. Other than that, we are all flawed. And so this idea that government has that somehow this entities like the FDA or the CDC or any of these things, the World Health Organization, are going to protect us is a fantasy and it's completely false because these entities are made up by human beings and as such, they are fallible. And when they have no fidelity to the patient, they are not going to be making decisions in the best interest of patients. And so when I talk about competition, what I'm talking about is the best way to compel me as a provider to be the best version of myself, I need to be in a competitive marketplace where I'll work as hard as I can to be the best that I can be. I will keep up on my studies and my education. I will practice my craft. And then when it comes to charging money, which right now doctors have virtually no say in the cost of their services because just about every doctor these days is employed, and that was by design by the big cabal wanting to control healthcare, in a competitive marketplace, that is what's going to keep your price at the lowest possible price, right? Because people ask me, how much would you charge for something? And the answer is the same answer every person would give, as much as I could get. Well, what keeps your prices down? Well, if my competitor out there is selling the same thing I'm selling for less, I got to compete with that. And so what happens is as we compete in a competitive marketplace, the prices keep going down. Some people can't figure it out, so they go out of business, right? If you can't figure out a way to deliver the same quality goods and services that your competitor is, you go out of business. That's the beauty of the free market. And what it does is it inspires, it compels, it forces individuals to get better and better and better. And then people with aptitude in this space, whatever that space is, eventually get the cost down to as low as they could possibly be. And that benefits the consumer because it leads to the highest quality of product and service. It leads to the greatest choice and it leads to the lowest price. And I'm going to kind of prove this to you guys. I want to kind of take a little trip down memory lane and take a little bit of my own personal experience to try and emphasize these points that the only way for us to resolve healthcare is to get government out of the way and allow providers to compete in a marketplace and start to produce healthcare. We're already starting to see this happen because our healthcare has deteriorated so much that you see a lot of concierge type doctors, and this works very well for primary care type services. We're still working on how to deliver the more costly services, surgical things, and, you know, obviously catastrophic healthcare situations, because the cost can be prohibitive, and that's why a lot of us are bought into the insurance industry. But the reality is, the insurance industry is in cahoots with government, and through regulation, they actually are gouging us. They're making tons of money off of the healthcare system, right? The government and power brokers in healthcare, they understand that there is a ton of money and a ton of power in healthcare. And the thing that used to be in the way of controlling it was doctors and patients. And so over the last decades, the government has steadily worked to disempower doctors and patients by creating an insurance system. And the insurance system disconnects the person purchasing the goods and services from their money, right? So you pay a deductible, you pay a premium to pay for your health insurance. You kind of get a little, you know, maybe you get some papers that kind of tell you what's covered and what's not covered. It's all very complicated. This is all by design. Insurance companies are very good at the bait and switch. They make you think you have coverage, and then when it comes down to it, it's like, oh, in this particular situation, it's not covered. Oh, in this particular situation, your deductible is $10,000, and because your deductible is so high, you can't actually access the service. And this is just a very creative way that they've created to create the illusion that you have purchased something in a free market, but at the end of the day, you really have some form of a government ration system. And you might say to yourself, well, Scott, they have companies out there, right? I mean, they have Aetna, they have Humana, they have Blue Cross Blue Shield, United. You know, they have multiple insurance companies out there. That's a little bit true, but after the passage of Obamacare, without getting into the weeds of the law, basically said it's a one-size-fits-all. Every medical policy has to cover everything that the government decided they wanted to cover. So you no longer can go purchase a catastrophic plan at a low price when you're young and healthy, like I did. Now you have to buy the full Obamacare. And the government was very creative in creating a system where the system costs a ton of money. And so what they did is, for people with the means to pay it, they have massive premiums. Okay. And for those who needed to be subsidized to get it, their premiums were offset onto the people who could afford it, but their deductibles are so massive that when somebody who's poor and needs to be subsidized needs to access the healthcare system, they can't afford the deductible, and so they end up not getting the care. And so it's a win-win for the government. And I can just remember I was working with a government – well, I was working with a private group that is fighting for conservative, situations, primarily in business. And they wanted to get with doctors to come up with a healthcare plan. This was many years ago. And so I was one of those doctors. And the idea was that we would put doctors that are actually in the crucible of practicing medicine with real world experience, that we would put them out front. But that never really happens, right? You have the same players that all want to get on TV. They all want to take advantage of this, whatever the situation is. The issues in government, they never want to be solved by these people. They just want the issues to be there, and they all make money off it. So politicians get money and power off it. The lobbyists make money and power. Politicians that then become the talking heads we see on TV, they don't really care about resolving these issues. In my experience, they just want to make money off it. And when Obamacare was coming around, you know, we wanted to fight against this. And so I remember being on one of your favorite news stations at the time, and one of the hosts, which we, I think most of the people listening to this show would know that this host, even though he was on our favorite news channel, is not really 100% into free markets, started grilling me with questions. And his whole intent was to discredit our concept of free market healthcare by just asking a bunch of painful questions, you know, about, you know, people are going to be left uncovered. You don't care about the poor and all this kind of stuff. And it's so ridiculous because that is exactly what is happening right now in our current healthcare system. You don't have providers that know what to do, and it's many fold. So the system has been destroyed from the top down, and this has been going on for a long time. And let's just, I want to take a trip down memory lane with my own experience to kind of give you guys my perspective about what I'm seeing in terms of the healthcare quality that you get. Now, I think most people listening to the show would agree that the people that we want in healthcare should be based on a pure meritocracy. I mean, I feel that way with everything. I want the best people always doing every good and service that I can get, but some matter more than others, right? Healthcare would be one of them. People flying my planes, I want to be the best. And of course, there's a lot of crazy politics going on now that's significantly impacting, the idea that we're getting the best possible pilots. Well, the same thing has been happening in healthcare, because as a young person, trying to figure out what I wanted to do in this world, you know, I remember my father, I think I've shared on this show before, my father asked me when I was in ninth grade or something, he said, hey, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I was like, well, professional soccer player, of course. And so he kind of chuckled and he said, okay, well, after you're done playing, what do you want to do? And I was like, well, I hadn't thought about it. And he said, well, you ought to give it some thought, because there's a lot of things to consider out there. He's like, you know, do you want to work indoors? Or you want to work outdoors? You want to work with your hands? You want to sit at a desk? You know, you want to wear a coat and tie? You want to wear shorts and a t-shirt? How much money do you want to make? How much vacation time do you want to have? And I just remember I was like, oh my gosh, like that's a lot. I got to start thinking about it. And the very first thing that entered my mind was my father was a naval officer in the military. And so as a young person, I had experience with government bureaucracy, and I had an instant natural repulsion to it. It was just stupid to me. It didn't act in a rational way. I know my dad, you know, all of the issues he had to deal with in his life, dealing with a government bureaucracy, was very frustrating. And I said to myself in my mind immediately, well, I don't want to be involved with government or a government bureaucracy or anything like that. You know, my parents fought a lot about money when I was a young kid, and it was sort of a painful thing. And I remember thinking to myself, I want to make enough money that I'm not going to fight with my wife in front of my children over money. And so, you know, I never really thought about being wealthy, but I just wanted to make enough to not have to worry about being able to pay my bills. You know, I wanted something that's challenging. I've always been kind of a challenging kind of person. My mother was a nurse, and both my parents instilled in me that you need to love what you're going to do at work, because you're going to be there for most of the rest of your life. And that really stuck with me. Like, okay, what do I want to do? And at the time, all I wanted to do was be a professional soccer player. And when I was done being a professional soccer player, I wanted to do something that was challenging, that was going to allow me to hang around athletics. And that's when I got the idea of becoming a sports medicine doctor. I had no idea at the time even that you needed to go to medical school, but I was kind of like, let me do that. The other thing I thought that was important was I was an ADHD kid back in the day before they really understood this. I was on Ritalin. My mother was a nurse, and she used to cut my pills in half, and I basically was getting a subtherapeutic dose. But the idea was, you know, I was a hyperactive kid. I remember in the fourth grade hearing Mrs. Watkins talking to some parents about me, and she said to those parents, I can't have every kid in the class not sit next to him. And I remember overhearing this. It really wounded me and made me feel terrible about myself, that, you know, why don't parents want their kids sitting next to me? And it was because I was the hyperactive kid and I was disruptive and all this kind of stuff. I also had a severe reading disability that I didn't know about, and I've shared the story of my reading disability on this show a bunch, but it really affected me when I was young. I felt very stupid. I felt very inadequate. I never was able to do any kind of reading comprehension very well, and it just made me feel like a dumb person, and I was worried about going through this world, everybody looking at me like I was a dummy. And so the idea of becoming a doctor appealed to me because I thought to myself, well, I'll get some automatic street cred just by being a doctor. Like, I'll be able to conceal how stupid I am by being a doctor. And that actually entered my mind. And so these were sort of the things that went into my mind about what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so you fast forward, I go through college, you know, I didn't do great, 2.9 GPA, started applying to medical school, didn't get in. And correctly, I hadn't earned it at that point, but I wanted it. I wanted this. I wanted it so bad. And as I started thinking about it more and more and developing my character as a human being and, you know, my parents nurturing the idea of service, and generosity and kindness and, you know, true fulfillment in life is service to others. I started developing my Christian faith, which, you know, compelled me to be a better person. I wanted to be a better person. And it was even more, it became more of a passion of mine to become a doctor. And so I started applying to medical school and I wasn't getting in. And I had some other experiences in my life. I got recruited to play soccer at UCLA. They were the number one team in the nation at the time. And I was the Hawaii State Player of the Year. And just through a freak of circumstance, my high school football coach used to be play with Terry Donahue, who was the coach of the UCLA football team at the time. And I was also a pretty good high school linebacker, but not good enough to play college, not big enough. And so Terry Donahue called, because in those days they didn't really travel out to Hawaii to watch people play. They just looked at newspaper clippings. And he actually called my coach to see about recruiting me to play linebacker at UCLA. And my football coach, of course, told Terry, like, hey, listen, this guy's not a college football linebacker, but he's a heck of a soccer player. And so Terry Donahue reached out to Ziggy Schmidt, who's the coach of the LA Galaxy now. But he was the soccer coach, and I ended up getting recruited to go play soccer at UCLA. And I was like, man, this is great. I'm well on my road to my career as a professional soccer player, number one team in the country. This is going to be fantastic. And what I found out when I got there was I really didn't belong with these people. I just wasn't fast enough and quick enough. And it was the toughest year of my life being in that crucible of, training with world-class athletes every day and walking onto that field with a feeling of inadequacy, like I didn't belong. So every drill we did, I had to put in every single thing I had just to look like I belong. So when we ran, I was running as hard as we could. When we, you know, when we did sprints, I was running as fast as I could. I did everything as hard as I could just to not be exposed as not really belonging with these athletes. And it hurt me a lot because my entire life, I really thought I was going to be the next Pele. And then in an instant, you realize that's not what God's plan was for you. But God had a plan for me to train my character and to steal my medal, to not be a quitter and to work hard and understand, like, you don't have all of the best attributes in every situation, but God gives you a lot and you need to make the most of what you have. And so I learned not to quit. And that kind of became my thing. And my father would tell me, like, that's your superpower, is you don't quit. So anyway, without getting too much into my reading disability thing, I find out I have a reading disability after I graduate college. I end up getting into medical school on my fifth try. Took me 3 MCATs. And when I got to medical school, they had the option with my reading disability. I was able to get designated. They do this now, right? With kids, they understand that a reading disability doesn't mean you're dumb. It's just you don't process reading very well. And, you know, there are other ways to get information into your head. So at the time, I had an option of getting more time to take my exams in medical school, but I was terrified that if I took the extra time, there would be an asterisk next to any of my scores. And, you know, even though it's technically not supposed to be held against you. I thought they might do it. And in order to get into orthopedics, you have to graduate at the top of your class and have top board scores. Okay. And I didn't want to have an asterisk next to my scores and, you know, prevent my ability from getting into, orthopedics. And so I opted out of that program, and I had spent a year prior learning how to read. I went back to school to learn how to read for my reading disability. And one of the great things about medical school is the stuff that you read, you don't read quickly. You know what I mean? It's not like reading a novel. Like, you have to memorize every word of every sentence, which is kind of a good thing for a reading disability because nobody's blowing through that stuff. I mean, obviously certain people could read faster, but it really narrowed the gap for me. And I started, you know, looking around me, and because it took me 5 years to get into med school, and I promise there's a point to all this. This is not to talk about my experience. I'm trying to get you to understand what it takes to become a doctor and why it's important that we have this process. I started taking my exams, and, you know, medical school is a marathon. I mean, you have, you know, that first year we had like anatomy and pathology, microbiology, pharmacology, biochemistry, you know, like we had a lot of hard classes. And it's funny too, because I'll talk to people about, oh, what'd you take in med school? They'll be like, oh, I took biochemistry. Oh yeah, I took that in college. And I'll be thinking to myself, bro, you didn't take this biochemistry. This was like super, super intense and in depth. And then every 6 weeks, we would have an exam set on every one of our classes. And it was so stressful to go in, because I felt like my whole life depended on every one of these tests. And every time I missed a question, I was I was risking losing out on my dream. And so what I saw was there was a lot of different types of people in medical school. And so there's nothing special about doctors. There's some good, some bad. We all had different aptitudes. And I remember thinking to myself as I was going through this, like, the one thing that medical school really selects out for is people who are good at standardized tests, right? But other than taking standardized tests, it doesn't really select out for a lot of stuff. And we had some really corrupt people in there. You know, you would think that these were going to be great people, but they weren't. There were things, we had slides that we looked at that you needed to see in order to know what they were for the test in histology. So histology, you're looking at the cells of whatever, the gut or the kidney or whatever, and you need to recognize what these are. And if you've never seen the slide, you're not going to know what it is. And so what would happen is people would go to the lab and they would steal the slides, giving themselves a competitive advantage, and then preventing people from being able to see this. So, you know, very early on, I thought to myself, like, wow, these are not necessarily the best people. And this is an important concept when we think about the world we live in. Like, this is how we all are. So how do we keep people from being corrupt? Is it through government regulation? No, it's through competition. It's through competition. I'm going to pick this up when we come back. You're listening to Dr. Scott Barber on America's Web Radio. This is the Doctor's Lounge. We'll be right back.
This is Dr. Hal Schurz from the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I want to thank you for your support. Our show is brought to you by the Docs for Patient Care Foundation, which is the only physician-led healthcare think tank in the country. Our website is www.4pcfoundation.org. We need you to support our organization so that we can continue to bring you this show and the information that you need so that you can support the healthcare of you and your family.
If you want the truth about politics, medicine, weapons, classic cars, and more, you'll want to tune in to America's Web Radio. You can listen to all of your favorite shows live at www.americaswebradio.com or on demand on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. That's www.americaswebradio.com.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Doctor's Lounge. I'm Dr. Scott Barber, and you're listening to me on America's Web Radio. And we're talking about healthcare reform. And the only way that we are ever going to reform healthcare is to get government out of the way and allow practitioners to compete in a free marketplace where they can develop and innovate and create keep prices down to the lowest possible price. And I'm starting to try to explain how this works and why this works. The government would have you believe that they can have their few experts who decide what types of healthcare we should get and what types of healthcare we shouldn't get, where resources should be spent. And they are going to have regulatory agencies like the WHO and the CDC and the FDA that are going to protect us, and that is somehow the most equitable and fair way to deliver healthcare. And I'm here to tell you that is absolutely not true. And the first predicate I have here is you have to understand that we are operating from the concept that we are all flawed individuals. And it's not that the government agencies won't help you and won't protect you. It's that they can't do it. And they can't do it because they're made up of individuals that are fallible just like you and me. And I always use the example of the top of the muffin. And a shout out to my good buddy who sent me a Top of the Muffin t-shirt. But it was a good example of, I remember when I was first working at a healthcare club and one of my friends said, hey, why don't you go across the street to the cafe and get us a muffin? And I was like, great. So I went and I did it. And I was looking at the muffin and I split it from top to bottom. So I took the top half and the bottom half, and the bottom half was bigger. The top half was smaller, and I gave her the bottom. And she looked at me. She's like, what are you doing? And I was like, what? She's like, you cut the muffin and gave me the, and I was like, yeah, I gave you the bigger half. And she goes, I know, but I like the top. I was like, oh, I like the top. And she looked at me and she goes, everybody likes the top. And I was thinking to myself, like, I honestly did not even consider that. I just thought to myself, I like the top of the muffin. And in my mind, I was kind of thinking I'm being extra fair because I'm kind of giving her the bigger portion of the muffin. And not even really thinking about the fact that maybe she wanted the top of the muffin too. This is the human condition. This is how we are. Government bureaucrats don't think about what you want, need, or desire. They don't care. And what's more, they don't know. These people have no idea what they're doing. And every time I see a government agency try to run anything, it just drives me crazy because I'm working in my own business, my own company, that I have tremendous expertise and all the skin in the game. Everything matters to me, and everything is brutally difficult, brutally difficult. I have to be involved in how my phones get answered. I mean, I have to spend hours and hours and hours on how the phone system, hey, welcome to Barber Orthopedics. If you speak English, press 1. If you speak Spanish, press 2. You have no idea how much effort, energy, time, money, and meetings and all kinds of stuff holding people accountable goes into that simple task and monitoring it and maintaining it. The government doesn't put any effort into this stuff at all, not only because they don't care, there's no consequences to them for not getting it right, but they couldn't do it. It's not their expertise. And sadly, for a lot of these government politicians that spend their entire life in government, they don't know anything about anything because they've never had to do anything. And they have this idea like, well, we'll just lower prices. Like, that doesn't affect the whole system. You cannot do price controls. That's just basic economics. So getting back to medical school and proving to you that there are not special, super nice people that are just going to be altruistic towards you out of the goodness of their heart. That's just a fact. There has to be another way to help us get great quality healthcare that is designed for us. And the way to do that is through competition, incentives, and consequences. That's how we do things. So here I am, my situation. And listen, I do think I'm a great doctor. I think I'm an objectively great doctor. And this is not to talk about me. Listen, I'm a very flawed individual and I am so blessed in this world. I have done absolutely the most I could do with what God gave me. And, this is also not a story about woe is me. I mean, I've had a great ride. I'm just trying to share the experience of nobody picked me to be a doctor. All right. When I went back to one of my high school reunions, my 20 or 30 or something like that, and people from high school would say, what do you do now? And I'd be like, I'm an orthopedic surgeon. They would laugh at me and go, no, man, really, what are you doing? I was like, no, I actually am an orthopedic surgeon. Nobody thought that's who I was. Right. I was once at a counter when I was applying to medical school, and I could not remember how to spell hospital. I couldn't remember if it was O-L or A-L. And I remember thinking to myself, I don't think they're going to let me into medical school if I can't spell hospital. You know what I mean? Like, that's the kind of person I am. But I changed who I was through hard work and perseverance. And God created a crucible for me where he taught me to maintain my toughness and to instill and develop and nurture a no-quit attitude. And I feel like my time at UCLA, as painful as it was, helped me with that mindset of just going out day after day and just doing the best I can in an environment where I just didn't have the tools. And so now you show up in med school and I'm thinking to myself, I have a responsibility to my future patients to know this material inside and out, and I am committing to this. And so I'm telling you, my first 2 years of medical school, I studied between 4 hours and 20 hours every single day except for 12 days in 2 years. I mean, and then I took these exams and I would watch smarter, more capable people not be able to do this because they just couldn't keep up with the rigor. Day after day after day after day of hard stuff, you know, biochemistry, anatomy, pathology, you know, physics, all these things. You had to know all this stuff and they tested you to detail that was ridiculous. I mean, it was always a big joke in medical school. And those of you out there who went to medical school, you know this, like whenever they said you're not responsible for knowing this chart, you know, everybody's like, okay, the whole test is going to be this chart. Like it was frustrating the way they would try and throw you off the scent. And so you had people that were folding under the pressure, and that folding manifested itself in a lot of different ways. Sadly, we had one student committed suicide, you know, and that was a big deal. The people at medical school were always concerned about your mental health and well-being. They were worried about the pressure was going to cause people to kill themselves. And it was just sort of, I thought it was a little over the top. Like, man, are there really people that are that fragile out there that are, you know, considering this? I mean, I get it. This is hard and all that, but it just seemed odd to me, but I get it now. And back in the day too, you know, I didn't get into medical school until my fifth try. So I was pretty much 5 years older than most of my classmates. We had several medical students that were older than me, but I was 5 years more mature. And that's a big 5 years, right? The difference between being, you know, 21 and 26 is a big deal. And so I had more maturity, which made me better able to handle the rigors of medical school and also to commit to it. You know what I mean? I had already done young people stuff and had freedom, everything. Like, I was ready for this fight. And so I got in there and I just started studying. But you saw people that would fold under the pressure. They would cheat. They would quit. You had people that would put a lot of effort into one class so that they could get an A, but then blow off other classes so that they could put extra time into those classes. But for me, I had to get an A in every class. At least I felt I had to get an A in every class in order to be able to get into orthopedics. And so, you know, I studied really hard. I never took any days off. We would have these exam sets that were spread apart by 6 weeks. And I would take one day off after, and the very next day I was right back at it. Other kids would, you know, take 3 weeks off to kind of chill and then they'd start ramping it up, and that just wasn't enough time. The volume of information was so massive that you just couldn't take that time off. And because I put the effort in my first year learning anatomy and physiology and all that kind of stuff, when I went on to microbiology and physics and or pathology and these other things, I was better able to learn that because I had a better foundation in the other things. It's like everything builds on it. And then when I got onto the floors, you know, a lot of the teachers used to call me Rain Man because I had a good command of the facts. And I was also good at bringing them up on the floor in a practical setting. And then there was something else that went on. I started really wanting to be the person, and this came from my faith, about you need to imagine the person you want to be, see that person, and live up to that person. And so, you know, I can remember wanting to I didn't want to be a weasel. You know, I had been trained by my father and others that tough times don't test your character. Tough times reveal your character. And I always say, even to this day, I say it to myself when I'm going through something and I want to scream and lash out and, you know, attack and all this and be at my worst. I think to myself, how do you want your character to be revealed? And I do my best. And one of the things that I would do is in medical school, when you would get copies of old tests, it was a real advantage, right? Because you have more questions to kind of see where the teacher's going with certain things. And so you had people that would get these old tests, and we would all know if somebody had a test, and you had the hoarders. If they got a test, they would keep it to themselves. And then you had people that I wanted to be, where if I got an old test, I would copy that test and I would walk around the library to all of my classmates and I'd say, hey, I got this old test, and I would give it to them. Others did the same thing. The point I'm trying to make is that was a character issue. I was giving my opponents, and that's the way my classmates were, right? If I need to graduate at the top of my class, like these people that I'm competing against are my opponents, because I'm wanting to get into orthopedics because I'm in a competition, right? This is the beginning of free market healthcare. I'm trying to learn my craft to the best of my ability so that I can go out into the marketplace and compete. And at the same time, I was working on my character, as others were, and it was hard. You know, I remember like thinking to myself, like, man, I could really use the advantage, but it's more important to me not to be thought of as a weasel. All right. I remember in second year, the worst thing that could happen when you needed time to study and you would get stuck in these long operating cases, you know, 8-10 hour cases, it was torture. You're just standing there. You can't do anything. You can't hear anything. You can't see anything. And because I'm an ADHD kid, that kind of thing is just pure torture to me. And then on top of it, I'm missing hours to study that my competitors are getting. And so in the mornings on these cardiothoracic rotations in surgery, you would stand out front and they would select the students and what cases you're going into. And some of the cases were long heart transplant surgeries. And then other cases were like 20-minute ports. So, you know, simple surgeries, you're 20 minutes, you're out, and you can go study for the rest of the day. And so what would happen is the heart cases were super important. So they weren't messing around. So they would be out first. They would pick their students. They would go into the room. And then, you know, the port people, the simple cases would get selected later. And so what you would find is a lot of medical students would run to the bathroom. Right. So they wouldn't be there to get picked. And I remember thinking to myself, I would love to be running to the bathroom right now so that I don't get stuck in these long cases. But I also didn't want to be a weasel. And to this day, I'm proud of myself for standing out front each and every day and just taking my chances, which cost me a lot. You know, I lost a lot of time to study, which put me behind the eight ball. But it was more important to me not to be a weasel than be a good person. And the reason I typically, like, I'm not here to talk about me. I'm here to talk about what goes into becoming a good doctor and the effort and the differences in effort and the differences in aptitude. And the fact that in medical school, the things that they select for don't necessarily translate into being a great doctor. The other thing is, there are different types of doctors that make great doctors. Like, I am a great orthopedic surgeon, but I would be a terrible pediatrician. Right? I am a great orthopedic surgeon, but I would be a terrible psychiatrist. And that's why, in order to get the best people in an important endeavor like medicine, you need to create an environment that allows for competition. It's no different than a sports team. You bring in the best athletes and they compete. And these people are already big, strong, and fast, but they need to be bigger, stronger, faster. And so they work hard. And the ones that work super hard are super successful. And I remember with Jerry Rice when I was with the Raiders. Jerry Rice was out there. He's already considered to be the greatest wide receiver of all time. And that guy showed up first, left last, and he worked as if he was the worst wide receiver in the NFL. And I remember thinking to myself, like, that is a life lesson right there. Like, nobody outworked that guy. And my dad used to say that all the time. You find something that you love to do in this world, and then you can work harder than anybody else because you'll never be at work. Because if you do what you love, you're not working. And that's what happened to me with medicine. And so I got out into the world and I said to myself, all right, now I'm a good doctor. And listen, this is the thing that drives me crazy about the left is they always talk about their academic pedigree as if that's the finishing line. Your academic pedigree is nothing, right? I'm about to get my black belt in Krav Maga. I don't know anything. Getting my black belt in Krav Maga is allowing me to get to the starting line where I can now really start to learn the craft. The black belt just signifies now you have the requisite knowledge that we can actually begin the training, right? That's what our degrees are. schools and degrees and all that kind of stuff, that just gets you to the starting line, but not for people who go into government. They show up not knowing anything about anything and they never learn again. And they just pass laws and regulations and things about that without having any understanding about how one thing affects another. Okay. So now I'm getting out of medical school. I know I'm objectively a good doctor. I have letters of recommendation over and over again sent from people saying this is the best resident ever to come through. All of my board scores were always in the 80th, 90th percentile of orthopedic surgeons. So, you know, Top Gun type stuff, like best of the best. You know, I did well. The other thing, I know how to do a lot of things. You know, you have, nowadays, because of the incentive structure, we have these hyper specialized doctors who, you know, they know how to operate from the elbow to the wrist and that's all they do. Well, in a real world scenario, that's not useful. There's not enough people that have that problem that can support a doctor that just does that. And that happens because of artificial government regulation, wasting resources, training a doctor that has very limited use in the real world, you know? And so, now you get through your training. All right. And now you're going to get out into the marketplace. Well, here's what happens. This is the beginning of the government control. In order for you to start practicing after you finish your training, you have to get credentialed on the insurance plans, Health, Blue Cross Blue Shield, United, Humana, and they in many cases are just not credentialing new doctors. Why are they not doing that? Because they have a system with a rationed amount of doctors that accept Blue Cross Blue Shield, which allows them to slow roll the consumption of resources. That's the healthcare industry's plan, right? What they do is they just make it really difficult for you to access the system, hoping that you'll just go away. And that's what happens in many cases. This is ostensibly rationing. Okay. So if you had a lot of doctors coming out that could just hang their own shingle and start, you know, I remember when I first got out, like, why am I not just, on every insurance plan? Why not? I'm board certified. I'm trained. I have great grades, all that stuff. I'm ready to go. Why am I not? And it's like, they don't want that. They don't want you to be credentialed. What's more is I have to also get credentialed at a hospital system. Now, one of the things that happened at these hospital systems during the Obamacare years was they needed to get rid of the independent doctors. And so, for example, as an orthopedic surgeon, I have to take call at a hospital as part of my privileges to be able to operate there. And so while I'm taking call, patients come into the emergency room and they would normally refer those patients to me and then I could build my practice. Well, what they started doing was if you were not an employed physician of the hospital, they would not refer to you. And so they slowly drove doctors that were in private practice out of business by refusing to give them referrals, even though they were compelled to take call at the hospital. They wouldn't get the referrals of the patients that came in. And I just remember having this meeting at one of the hospitals with all the doctors when they were kind of basically saying, this is how it's going to be, that we, if you're not employed at this particular hospital, we will not be giving you any referrals. And one of the doctors started crying. I mean, crying like, oh, this is not fair. And I'm like, yeah, bro, life is not fair. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I mean, it's not right. This is terrible. It's corrupt, all those things, but it's life. And what did you think was going to happen? I mean, this is why I was fighting against government run healthcare my whole life, is this is just was the next step in the pot. Okay. And so what you have is you're driving private doctors out of business. And so that most doctors now are employed by hospital systems. And then here's where the real situation comes in, right? The hospital systems are controlled by government. And the reason is because most of their funding comes through government allocation of money through Medicare, Medicaid, SCHIP, right? And your hospital systems in big cities are just like the teachers' unions, right? You have the teachers and the politicians sitting at the table and the teachers say, we need more money. And the teachers' unions, acting on behalf of the teacher saying the teachers need more money, and the politicians go, okay, let's give you more money. And where do they get it? They get it from the taxpayer who does not have a seat at the table. And so that money then goes to the teachers And then the teachers then take that same money and give it back to the politicians to allow those politicians to stay in power. And it's just a corrupt system where education, the quality of it just gets worse and worse and worse. And I think during COVID, people are able to see just how bad they've gotten. Not just that they're not teaching your kids, but they're indoctrinating them into all kinds of crazy stuff. And you're paying for it. And you don't have a seat at the table. And it's really frustrating. Well, the healthcare system is no different. If a politician comes in and says, hey, listen, I'm not going to vote for having more tax dollars go to these hospital systems for all this stuff. Then what happens is the massive number of people that are employed by these hospital systems go and vote that politician out because they don't want a politician who's going to prevent more federal dollars and state dollars from flowing into that hospital system that they can get their hands on. And so what happens is you have another system where politicians voting to devote more money and power to these hospital systems, and then those hospital systems then take that same money and contribute it back to those politicians to keep them in power. And then we as citizens trying to access the healthcare system, we're getting our taxes raised and we don't have very good access to healthcare. All right. And not only that, but once the physicians are employed, the physician's fidelity is no longer to the patient, right? The fidelity is to the hospital. And we saw this during COVID, right? And without litigating COVID, let's just admit there were multiple treatments, right? The government narrative was they wanted you to be vaccinated. They wanted you to be masked. They wanted you to be locked down. They wanted you to take remdesivir if you got admitted to the hospital. And then there was kind of another line of treatment where hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, masks don't work, vitamin D and zinc, the early treatment protocol that has now been proven to be effective, but the government wouldn't allow it. And you couldn't go to a hospital and get that treatment. And I had situation after situation where families were like begging me, like, can't we treat my family member, my dad, my mom, can't we treat them another? No, we have no power. The government controls this. And it's not just on COVID stuff. The government and the hospital systems control the care that you get. And I've shared this story with you before that I once got consulted on a patient that had an infected total hip. And so I was on call. They called me. So I went up to the floor to go see the patient, and the patient wasn't in the room. And I came out and I asked the nurse, I was like, hey, where's the patient? And she said, oh, they're down getting a CT scan. And I was like, well, why are they getting us? What are they getting a CT scan? And I said, oh, they're getting a CT scan of the hip. And I'm thinking to myself, like, but I'm the hip guy and I don't want a CT scan of the hip. Like, it's an unnecessary study. And I looked into this, and the reason it turned out that they got the CT scan was Medicare will pay for it. So you got a hospital system that is not really designed towards treating the patient. They're just designed towards trying to run up the bill as much as possible through the arrangement that they have through the government entity of Medicare and Medicaid. And it's not that the government doesn't know this is going on. I mean, it's a symbiotic relationship. The hospitals get money from the government, and the politicians maintain political power through the control of healthcare. And so when you have private doctors that are out there trying to do the right thing by their patients, they have been slowly getting squeezed out of the equation over a long period of time, and this eventually strangles the supply. So you've got new doctors that are coming out of training. They can't really hang their own shingles, so they have to go get employed by the hospital or by an entity that is already in practice. So, for example, I could hire a new doctor coming out, and they would be credentialed under my tax ID number. But that would make their money my money, and that doesn't lead to a great development of independent providers, because I really have control over this young doctor because they have a hard time leaving, because in medicine we get paid so far in the rears, right? If I do a health insurance case, I might not be paid for like 6 months, right? So if I get a doctor and they decide like, hey, I've learned enough and I'd like to go, next door and start competing with you, they can't do it because I have so much of their money. I mean, they could do it. That's what I eventually did, but they'd have to be willing to leave 6 months of money on the table. And so this is a disincentive to creating a competitive marketplace. Now, there's so many other things. And I realized when I did this show Well, I'm realizing now that this is a much longer talk, and I'm going to have to probably do part two next time. But what I'm trying to say here is, in a very simple way, there's no question that free market healthcare is not only the best way, it's the only way to give us quality, affordable healthcare. Rationing healthcare resources is not effective because the people that are running it have no idea what they're doing. They don't know medicine, and it's not a knock on them. It's just you can't know about it, right? They don't know what it is. So they don't know how to ration this very complex system, whereas the people that know how to do it are basically banned from running it. Like, physician-owned hospitals are illegal. Well, why is that? Well, the regulators would tell you, well, it's a conflict of interest if a doctor, if a doctor owns the hospital. That's ridiculous. What's a conflict of interest is the government controlling everything, and they get to control what services we get. And we saw it during COVID, right? You got a one size fits all treatment. You got masks, you got vaccinated, and you got remdesivir. That's it. But what you didn't get was hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, not masking, vitamin D, all that stuff, right? And listen, at this point, you know, we saw that when the government controlled all the agencies, right, they shut down debate because they didn't want to hear it, right? They had their money coming in a certain way, and people who were trying to offer an alternative viewpoint, which is science, right, that we debate in the marketplace of ideas, they shut us down, which is another glaring example of why one-size-fits-all government-run healthcare not only won't, it cannot work. It will not work. And so what we have to do is, anytime some politician comes in, and this is what's going to be happening in this election cycle, they're going to talk about what is your healthcare plan. There is no healthcare plan. It is too complex a situation to resolve. And listen, there's areas of, I'm not an expert in every area of healthcare. I'm an expert in my area of healthcare, but the principles are the same. Supply and demand. The whole world operates by a series of incentives and consequences. We have, there's the four ways that we spend money, right? And the most efficient and best way to spend money is for people to spend their own money on themselves. And that's impossible in healthcare, right? And that is by design. So, for example, I always use the example, like, I've got this little bottle of water for me, and you might be thirsty, and I might say, hey, would you like this water? And if I told you, okay, it's $500, even though you're thirsty, you might be like, well, I want water, but I'm not paying you $500 for that little thing of water. Well, in healthcare, you are paying $500. And the way they do it is they bury it in your premiums and deductibles. You have no idea what that money goes for, right? We're just so conditioned. We buy our insurance. Everybody else is doing it. We show up and they like, okay, your deductible's 10 grand. It's like, what? And we all have this experience, right? Oh, I got to do everything by the end of the year because my deductible's met and I need to get all this other stuff done. That's ridiculous. They're purposely disconnecting you from your money so that you cannot see what you're paying for things, and that is affecting the cost and quality of our healthcare. Now, we need to, in order to reform healthcare, we need to get the best people. And the way we get the best people is we incentivize them. And the way you incentivize them is with money, prestige, the work environment, job security, challenging stuff, all those types of things. It's a free market. We have to have training. The government has intervened on training. I didn't even get to that today, but the more government puts regulations on training, the more we're creating worse doctors. Like, they're so worried about how much sleep doctors get that they basically make them have less experience. And I'll get into more of that next week. And we have to have a competitive marketplace. This idea that somehow government is going to just pick the price is ridiculous. It can't happen. And the only way to get low prices is to have quality people competing in a marketplace. And I do that every day in my own business. How do I give the best possible service so I can keep my patients happy? And how do I do it at the lowest price so I can maximize my own profit? And when I have competition, I work really hard to get my prices down. And when I don't have competition, I don't work very hard at that. And I still think I'm a pretty good person. I'm acting as any human being would be. man, I realize I just didn't even get to most of what we're talking about, but I hope I laid the predicate here for why the only solution to our healthcare situation is to decrease regulation. Okay. That's it. The plan for healthcare reform is no plan. Just get out of the way and let providers provide, and they will figure it out for you. I'm going to talk more detail on this next week. You've been listening to Dr. Scott Barber on the Doctor's Lounge. This is America's Web Radio. We'll see you all next week.
The views, opinions, and content of the show hosts and their guests appearing on America's Web Radio are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of the station.
You're listening to America's Web Radio on the AmericasBroadcastNetwork.com. Thank you for listening.